Chapter 69. The Membership Experience. As a newbie member of the Findhorn Foundation, I was given a well-lit single room behind the Clooney kitchen. It had a long window, with wooden shutters, a sleeping loft with an access ladder, a chest of drawers, a small table, a hand basin, and most important of all, the room was heated by a wall-mounted radiator that was fired by the basement furnace. The heating was vital, because this was my first Scottish winter, and I was feeling the cold. Even so, in spite of the drop in temperature, I was looking forward to watching snowflakes cover everything with whiteness. The first snowfall brought out the kid in me, and I felt compelled to build a snowman, an impulse that sprang from my memory of the snowman Christmas cards from my sun-drenched Australian childhood. My creation had a carrot nose, and a woolen scarf for warmth. Even though Clooney numbers decreased markedly in winter, there was always someone to play with. Needless to say, there was lots of interest in the snowball fight that followed, during which we laughed and laughed, until our sides ached. I was really enjoying my life at the foundation. Sure, there were work department commitments, and the occasional additional shift, but the rest of the time was my own. We were housed, fed, and entertained, including Saturday night movies at the Universal Hall, plus the occasional invitation to participate in a public workshop. I socialized, read, wandered the surrounding woods collecting chanterelle mushrooms in season, and explored the Forest High Street. Naturally, the fabric store became my home away from home, and now I was settled, I was on the lookout for a project. My relationship with Alan continued to be interesting. He was fully focused on getting the newly formed youth project off the ground, and I was happy as a lark, focalizing the freshly renovated Clooney laundry, which was now running super smoothly. Around this time, creativity struck without warning, and the story is worth telling. In the bowels of Clooney was a windowless room known as the boutique, where members and guests left clothing they no longer needed. The flip side was that those wanting to add to their wardrobe could take whatever took their fancy, but no money changed hands. Amongst the piles of neatly folded clothing, I discovered many fine, loosely spun woolen Shetland weight sweaters. They'd been discarded because of a stain or a hole, and many had shrunk as the result of being washed in hot water. This was a plus for the prototype I had in mind. I selected one patterned, and four plain sweaters, and began work. The result was a stylish, one-of-a-kind, never-to-be-repeated garment, a patchwork of largish pieces, with taped seams and an oversized black press stud front closing. The emphasis was on good design and sound construction. I finished the prototype, and wore it to a Clooney function that evening. 10 minutes later, it was sold for £85, a realistic price for an art garment. It was clear the Morley-made recycled woolen art sweater enterprise was off to a flying start. Early in my stay, the foundation hosted the New Economic Agenda Conference, drawing people from all over the country to speak and network. One of the attendees was a social worker from Easterhouse, a violent gang-controlled neighborhood of Glasgow, ravaged by unemployment and addiction. He and Alan got together, and the outgrowth of their collaboration was the first youth activist gathering held at the foundation, the 1985 Terra Nova Conference, hosted by the Youth Project. The success of the conference brought Alan to the attention of foundation's decision makers, as well as the wider community. In spite of his unconventional approach, he demonstrated serious team management skills, handy to have when organizing annual conferences on pertinent themes, as the foundation did. To escape the flurry of foundation life that tested relationships, we occasionally took off to Glasgow. On one memorable occasion, we arranged to visit the Glasgow School of Art. I was keen to visit, because this art school was one of the best in the country. I'd a letter of introduction from a Scottish colleague in Toowoomba, who had taught there before moving to Australia. But, to be completely honest, I was driven by my desire to experience a Charles Rennie Mackintosh building. Rennie Mackintosh was an acclaimed Scottish architect, who, with his wife, Margaret, designed all aspects of the art school building both inside and out. As we were shown around, we basked in the ambience of the starkly beautiful interior spaces, with all the original fixtures, bookcases, shelving, desks, benches, chairs, metal and glass light fittings, ceramic tiles and wall stenciling, all of which had been produced by Team McIntosh. After a mega dose of aesthetics and culture at the art school, that evening Alan took me out drinking with his Easter House mates, where I experienced culture of a different kind. I was a fish out of water for two reasons. Firstly, I was not a tippler, heresy in this alcohol-soaked country, and secondly, I was unable to join in the conversation, because I found the Glaswegian dialect, spoken through clenched teeth, unintelligible, whether the speaker was drunk or sober. As a result, I spent the long evening smiling sweetly, and wishing I was somewhere else. In one day, I discovered Glasgow was a city of striking contradictions. Alan was so proud of his birthplace, and eager to show me around. I was grateful, because it's much more exciting to be shown the sights of any city by a native. Before heading back to Cluny, Alan wanted me to see a relic of the Industrial Revolution, the vast new Lanark cotton mill, not far from Glasgow. For Alan, a social idealist, New Lanark represented a shining example of what was possible when capital and labor joined forces to benefit both. He explained how David Dale, a far-sighted Scotsman, recognized the power-producing potential of the Clyde River and, in 1784, set about building the complex in a village for the mill workers nearby. In 1800, ownership shifted to Dale's son-in-law, the social pioneer Robert Owen. Under his progressive management, the new Lanark mill and village became a model community, where the quest for progress and prosperity, made possible by new cutting-edge Industrial Revolution technology, was tempered by a caring and humane regime. Once there, we decided to brace ourselves, and leave the comparative warmth of the car to wander between the grey stone buildings in the blustery Scottish bleakness, surrounded by the constant sound of the falls of Clyde Water, rushing past the complex. As we wandered, I imagined the generations of inhabitants who'd lived and worked in this relentlessly cold and damp place, which was in sharp contrast to my experience of weather. Every country in which I'd lived to date, Australia, New Guinea, Africa, and Mexico, was for the most part, warm and sunny. During our four-hour drive back to Cluny, Alan and I had plenty of time to discuss both the highs and lows of our Glasgow visit, after which we moved on to discuss the possibilities of our future together. Here in Scotland, my life had taken a most interesting turn, and I wondered what had happened next. On reflection. Alan. In hindsight, I realize I was fortunate to be in a relationship with a native Scot. He introduced me to fascinating aspects of Scotland and Scottish life I'd never have experienced, had it not been for his willingness to share his culture. Alan was also happy to share his vehicle. Each time I drove it, I realized how much I missed the freedom a vehicle provided, and, as it turned out, it wouldn't be too long before I bit the bullet and invested in one of my own. Driving in Scotland. I arrived in Scotland with an Australian driver's license, as well as an international one, just in case. When I finally joined the foundation, I took my various licenses to the Department of Transport, where, for an outlay of £10, I was issued with a British driver's license. To my surprise, this license was valid until I was 70, a long way off. Art sweaters. After the super quick sale of my one-of-a-kind art sweater prototype, I modified my construction technique and went on to make these garments until I left the foundation. I had difficulty keeping up with the demand, as many visitors wanted to take a piece of the foundation home with them, as a reminder of this crazy out-of-the-way community in the north of Scotland, with a focus on sustainability. I believe that I was implementing this ethos by recycling sweaters and supporting myself. I've always thoroughly enjoyed making and derive great satisfaction in recognizing the intrinsic value of cast-offs. Scotland provided a never-ending supply of sweaters to upcycle. Just before I left the foundation, I offered a one-day art sweater construction workshop for community stitchers. I was pleased to know that the innovative technique I'd devised would continue into the future. Sometime after I got back to Australia, I was delighted to receive a photograph of three of the workshop participants wearing their completed creations with obvious delight. Facts. The Mackintoshes. Charles Rennie Mackintosh and his wife, artist Margaret MacDonald Mackintosh, were a formidable creative team. Charles Rennie Mackintosh. Architecture historians describe the Glasgow School of Art, later named the Mackintosh Building, as his masterpiece. In life, he was plagued by ill health and alcoholism, but in death has come renewed appreciation of his genius, both at home and abroad. Today, his body of work is recognized on a level far beyond anything he received during his lifetime. He is now celebrated as one of Scotland's and the world's greatest designers. Margaret MacDonald Mackintosh. Margaret exhibited widely. Her work was celebrated by her peers and her husband, who, in 1927, wrote, "You must remember that in all my architectural efforts, you have been half if not three quarters of them." And, in another letter, wrote, "You have genius, whereas I only have talent." High praise indeed. Margaret died in virtual obscurity, in part due to living in the shadow of her husband. New Lanark. Thanks to Robert Owen's progressive vision, the people of New Lanark had many firsts. These included the first infant school in the world, the first day nursery for working mothers, the first free medical care, and the first comprehensive education system for children, as well as evening classes for adults. Children under 10 were not permitted to work in the mill. His progressive approach gained New Lanark an international reputation as a model manufacturing complex and the largest in Scotland. At peak production, New Lanark accommodated 2,500 mill workers and their families for almost 200 years.